And good evening. It is Intuitive Soul Radio with your host, Lori Houston. And this is the second portion of the evening where I have an author. And tonight's author, which I'm very excited because she is in the studio, is Aria Deepwater, who has written the book Love Threshold, Practicing the Art of Choosing Love in Every Moment. Welcome, Aria.
Thank you, Lori. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, you're still not very loud, but let's keep going, and maybe you can project yourself a little bit into the mic a bit better. Okay, so let's talk about your journey, because that's how I like to help people connect in with who you are and where you're going, and then it allows people to sort of relate more to you. Yes. So talk about your journey.
My journey began over 15 years ago now, spiritually began over 15 years ago. I was 21 years old. I was suffering extreme pain and extreme illness. I'd had contracted the virus that causes chronic fatigue syndrome when I was 6 years old, and had been living with disability and illness and severe limitation for 10 years. And I just knew that it was my soul and my spirit that was crying out for healing, even more so than my body. So I began to just explore that, and opened up to a whole new world of grace and understanding as a result, and have spent the last 15 years training and working in the field of spirituality, but specifically always through that modality of my physical body. I mean, I really do look at the illness as being my teacher, my body as being my teacher. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, the bottom of the bottom in terms of the lows, but over the years, constant improvement. And in the last couple, I've absolutely completely healed my physical form, and the spiritual blessings that have come as a result of that are endless and indescribable. And that's culminated in the writing of the book, really.
Mm-hmm. So you've transcended the pain and just absolutely gotten rid of everything. Plus you have that experience has allowed you to grow instrumentally in where you're wanting to go.
Absolutely. I was actually just at a meeting last night and attempting to explain it to someone who had no reference points either spiritually or with illness. And I said, you know, it is my teacher. It was my training, you know, that to be in a situation, we were talking a little bit about surrender earlier, and to be in a situation where you can't control what's happening with your body, to come from a place where you feel utterly and completely betrayed by your own body. I mean, my journey really began the day I realized that I had absolute hatred for my body. Mm. Absolute, like revulsion. I can't tell that story without bursting into tears, really. It was a terrible, terrible day, but at the same time, I had learned at that point just enough to realize that that's where the heart of everything was for me. And I committed myself at the age of 21 to really learning to live in love with my body. That's what I wanted. I didn't know what that meant. You know, whatever it looked like, whether it was crippled and disabled and I could never get out of bed again, I was going to be in absolute love with my body. And it took a while, and it was quite a training. But it's that place of having to come up against all of your limitations and to find a way to know that you're living your purpose and you're being your best self, even when you can't get out of bed, even when you're crawling across the apartment because you're afraid you're going to fall if you stand up. You know, it's bawling your eyes out, guts everywhere. I mean, it's just that kind of torture, really. I mean, it's a kind of personal torture to be in that level of pain and go into prayer and go into meditation and find your connection with spirit and soul and know that that is where you really live, and move from that place. I mean, those were some of my greatest moments.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of those pearls ended up in the book.
Sure. So how do you surrender to that depth? How do you just let go in that way and allow that, just have that trust and faith?
That's the big question, isn't it? The how. You know, this is something that is both sometimes frustrating to my students, but it's something that I will say 1,000 times in almost every class, and I repeat it over and over again in the book, which is it's really about practice. It ultimately is about practice. We have to come into it again and again and again until we finally learn how to let go. And your ability to let go in some situations is going to be more challenging than others. Mm-hmm. And I really do believe we have very unrealistic spiritual expectations of ourselves. And we, in the Western world, we've taken on this beautiful sort of individual, unique path to spirituality. But because we're still in the Western world that's so accomplishment driven, we mm-hmm. end up with this sort of secret shame that we're not good enough at it, because it doesn't just blossom and we're not just surrendered all the time and it's mm-hmm. not easy for us. Somehow we expect it to get to a certain point where we're, okay, I'm spiritually advanced now and this is supposed to be easy. And it never really is easy, ever. We can learn to find that joy through the practice, but the how really lies in the commitment and willingness. And that's why the three steps of the book or the system are designed that way. It's always about asking what is the loving thing to do and being courageous enough on a moment-to-moment basis to find that and listening to the guidance. I mean, that really is it. One of the worst moments I had where I was crawling across the apartment floor, I felt like I was at the end of everything. It was 10 years into my journey. I really felt like this should be paying off by now. I shouldn't still be sick. And it was just a horrible, horrible day. And I was just begging, just give me something to get me through the day. I went into prayer and I said, just give me something. And what I received back was a question. And that is, what if it never gets any better? What if this is it? And at the time, that's not the question I wanted to have answered for myself that day. But I begged again. I said, please don't make me face that. Don't make me ask that question. I need something to alleviate it, not make me think it's going to get worse. And it just came back at me. What if this is it? And that was a moment of true surrender, because I had to ask myself that question. And when I asked myself that question, the answer that came was, then I'll find a way. Again, that I'll find a way to live myself and be my purpose and find the best life for who I am, even if these are the circumstances. And surrender comes through acceptance. A lot of people don't realize that they're so intricately linked that we sometimes think they're the same thing, but they're not quite. Acceptance is what leads to surrender. Acceptance has to come before surrender does. We have to accept our circumstances or whatever it is that we're in pain about.
Mm-hmm.
And then surrender almost just comes automatically after that. But it's this acceptance we need to practice first. And that, again, it comes through practice. Facing it, being willing to love our way through it, and not fight it.
Mm-hmm. Yep, I think the big thing is that we believe that we can control it. We believe that we have control over our lives.
Exactly.
And our ego convinces us that, you know, we have to be in control.
Mm-hmm. And that is the huge, huge parts of my work are all about getting us out of our personality and into the core of who we are, into our soul, into our spiritual self. Because you're absolutely right. I don't speak a lot in ego just because a lot of people don't understand what the term means. So I talk about our personality, our human side versus our soul expression. And our human self is a beautifully, divinely designed mechanism of creation. But it's not meant to be the one in the lead. Mm-hmm. We're not meant to be leading our lives through our personalities. We're meant to be leading it from the core of who we are. And our personalities are meant to be responsive vessels. They're vessels just like our bodies are. And so if we can train them to be responsive to the core wisdom of our soul, then that's the true path to those spiritual advancement levels that we like to reach for.
Right. So you say in the book that love is the essence of who we are and it's our deepest responsibility.
Yes, I do. Yes, it is. That's, to me, it is absolutely the essence of who we are. I talk about big L love.
Right.
You know, there's little L love, which is the human emotion. Beautiful, inspiring. It can make us feel like we can move mountains. And I often say we don't really need to talk about the love that a parent can have for a child, say, for example. I mean, it's phenomenal. You'll often hear new parents talk about the fact that they never knew they could love the way they love now. And that, to me, is our heart responding to a spiritual impulse. Because realistically, when you think about it, that means love is conditional. You know, I couldn't love until this baby came into my life. Well, that means that baby is responsible for that level of love, and what happens if that baby disappoints or et cetera. So,
well, we know what happens.
Exactly. We know what happens.
we then make it conditional.
Exactly. So to move from that big L love, which is the love of our soul, and that is who we are. It's the essence, the energy. I believe love is the power of the divine in our individual forms. And when we move from that place, it becomes our responsibility to live it in life, to integrate it so that it can become the substance and the source and the supply of everything we do and all that we are. But we have to choose it. And that's where that balance between the personality and the soul comes in, because our personality needs to be trained to choose the love.
Mm-hmm. You talk about us practicing awareness and how we're mirrored and reflected. And when you think about, you know, the newborn baby, I mean, a newborn baby is source. It's not got its personality yet. It's not going to get it until it, you know, it won't be fully developed until it's probably around seven. So it is complete source. So when people say they've never felt love like this, it's because they're getting a direct mirror of divine love.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So practicing awareness, practicing understanding, and you talk about the thresholding, which is the system that you have created, and it's on spiritual growth and personal transformation. And it's, you know, there's a bunch of principles that you talk about, and, you know, I'd love to go through all of it. I hope we can get through all of it. I have no idea if we can, but that will mean that you just go out and purchase Aria's book, because it is full of a lot of information.
Yes, it is.
And it's not a light book.
No.
It's but it is a full book. So you also talk that each chapter has an activation. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Oh, my activations. They're one of my favorite things in the whole world. Life activation is a form of meditative prayer. And it's based on spiritual mind treatment from the Centers for Spiritual Living tradition. And I've sort of taken it and tweaked it and made it my own a little bit, because I love the form. And life activation is they're designed to activate both our conscious and subconscious awareness levels to whatever aspect of love that we want to bring into our lives. So we activate our life to love through this modality. Right. And so I wrote for each chapter and each principle, I wrote a small little activation to just sort of capture the energy and the essence. And we included them in the back of the book for just individually, so that if people have a favorite one, they don't have to worry about flipping to the specific page. They can just go to the back and read it to yourself to enhance that energy of that principle. Whatever aspect of life that you're working on, you can use it as a little tool to bring more of that energy into your consciousness and let it flow more freely.
Mm-hmm. And how did you come up with the idea or the essence of the love threshold system?
That actually happened, and I do tell this story in the book. I was on a road trip with a friend, and we had a huge argument. I mean, it was one of those things that just spiraled way out of control. And it ended up with, you know, me in an attempt to try to stay very calm and clear. And the person that I was with just wasn't able to do that. And I had pulled the car over and decided to get out and was off on the side of the road, not sure what was going to happen, because, you know, it was his car and he actually had my purse still in the car. And I actually heard the car drive away at one point. We were out in the middle of nowhere. And I just kept asking myself, what is the loving thing to do? Which is a practice I had developed years earlier. What is the loving thing to do? And the answer I kept receiving was, wait, keep your heart open, pray. So that's what I did. And within about 20 minutes, he came and found me again, and we were talking, and it turned into hours of truly, truly miraculously beautiful conversation, and something that I still to this day consider to be a great gift. And when debriefing about that a little bit with my girlfriends the next day, because I came home and I thought I was fine, and I woke up the next day and was feeling a little rattled. And I was talking about it with my girlfriends, and one of them talked about this question that I was asking myself, what is the loving thing to do? Because I kept saying, that's all I did. I just asked, what is the loving thing to do, and got through it. And she said, most people don't have the awareness to ask that question. And I had already been teaching for 12 or 13 years at that point, and had always looked for a container for my work, a single point that I could focus in on when people would say to me, Aria, how do you get through the challenging situations you get through? I would use examples in class of what I call courageous conversations that I would have with family members or friends or people that I was dating. And they would say, well, how do you do that? And this all of a sudden was the answer to that how. Mm-hmm. Ask the question, what is the loving thing to do? Receive the answer, wait for it, and then do what you're told to do. That's the step, or the three steps. And right. And so that idea of thresholding came from this notion that in every single moment, we have a place or level where love can begin. A lot of people think that threshold is a limitation. It's your capacity to live love, and you can't go any further than that threshold. But threshold, if you look it up in the dictionary, actually is defined as a place or level where something can begin. And I'm very intrigued by that. I'm intrigued by this beautiful idea that we can think we've reached our limitations, but it's actually just a beginning place.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. How hard is it to do what you're told?
That is actually probably, well, each step has its own unique difficulties, because when we're in the hubbub of the details, it can be very hard to practice the awareness to ask the question. But once we get that under our belt, the next hardest thing to do is learn how to listen for the answers, and we have to train ourselves to do that. But really, I think the trickiest part of the three steps is doing what you're told, mm-hmm. because it's scary, because often the answers we get, they go absolutely counterintuitive to where our personality wants to go, right? And then we talked about the ego, like our ego thinks we're in control. It wants to start screaming if we get scared. It wants to be passive aggressive if that's our tendencies. It wants to manipulate and control. And what we're told to do is often the exact opposite of that. And so it rattles us and it shakes us and it asks us to do things that are way outside of our comfort zone. I often say that love throws status quo right out the window. It throws social protocol right out the window. And we have to learn how to be authentic individuals following our deep inner guidance. And that is exceptionally scary, especially if you haven't been doing it before. Mm-hmm. And it is very, very tricky, but it's an amazing practice.
Yeah. Well, it's difficult to be authentic because we've been taught, you know, because of those conditions we were placed as a child, mm-hmm. we were taught that, you know, it's better to shut up and to just listen and to, you know, we have all of these conditions placed on what we were told or understood love to be from our human perspective.
Yes.
So being authentic and removing all of those masks that we have been hiding behind for so long is challenging.
It is. It's extremely challenging. And that gets right back to one of the first questions when we talked about surrender and the how. It's practice, right? I mean, we're not going to be perfect at it ever. And we're going to be better at it 2 days from now, 2 weeks from now, 2 months from now, 2 years from now than we are today. And it's a constant journey of growth and evolution. And that's when we get into that acceptance of where we are. We're right where we're meant to be, no matter what that looks like. And that authenticity comes through the acceptance as well. Because again, if I'm not trying to fight anything and I'm not trying to resist who I am or resist who the people are that are standing in front of me or resist the situation that I happen to find myself in, then I'm much more able to be who I naturally am instead of all of those coping mechanisms and the mechanics of dealing with the world that our personality develops, exactly as you said, through all of those conditions and limitations that are mm-hmm. placed on us as we grow up.
Yes, it's very fascinating, our lives. So the first principle is
asking the question creates space for the answer. And it's one of my favorites.
Well, it's your core. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's your core thing at this mm-hmm. point. And having that space and having that allowance to receive the answers.
And it really is one of the most delicious, delightful elements of spiritual development. And it's sort of a secret that a lot of people don't teach. And that is when we learn to really practice the right questions. our consciousness really truly does expand and respond. We're trained to, again, put ourselves in our egos or our personalities, our human heart and mind, and think that's where we know what's going on. But it's essentially limited. It has to be limited. You know, that it's finite. We don't take our personalities with us when we go.
Thank God.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, it is essentially limited. So if we're seeking guidance from our personality or from our ego, all we're going to be getting inherently limited guidance or inherently limited wisdom. Whereas if we put ourselves in our spirit and train our heart and mind to simply ask good questions and become the space for the answer, then that's when the wisdom really flows. And it's a mechanism that literally works on its own because we're designed for it. We're living the artificial, unnatural way through all of the conditions and the limitations and staying in our personality. The natural way for our personality to respond is to be open and restless and constantly seeking for answers. It's not designed to know. It's designed to ask the question, receive the answer, and then act on it. So that practice of asking the question, what is the loving thing to do?
Is that sort of like the terrible twos when they ask you why to everything?
Yes.
Well, actually, that goes on for quite a while, doesn't it?
Until
the parents get fed up and stop answering. But
yeah, you're absolutely right. We see that in our children. And we see it again. I mean, biochemically and hormonally, there's a big similarity between terrible twos and teenagers, right? Mm-hmm. Even as teenagers, your brains are being rewritten and there's a whole new period of growth happening. And that's why those two periods are so similar. But the theme of it is, again, it's questioning, it's seeking, it's challenging authority. You know, all of those beautiful things that are naturally in us to do that society tends to squash down. Mm-hmm. If we are trained in those times to be able to harness that energy and focus it to really listening for a deeper voice, I'm just taking a moment imagining what our life would be like.
Yeah.
If we had all been taught that, I mean, wouldn't it be lovely? But we weren't. So we have to train ourselves how to do it now at this point.
Right. You talk about will a lot in this chapter.
Mm. Our personal will, it is, again, one of the most profound teachings I received through learning and practicing the surrender and acceptance of my situation, is that I couldn't bulldoze my way through it with my will. I couldn't decide to feel good on a given day and trust that that was actually going to happen. And I really, over the years, began to realize that my personal will was designed for one purpose and one purpose only, and that is to train my attention. My will is to train my attention to love and what it is that I do with my heart and my mind and the energy of my personality. That's what the will is for. It's not actually a defensive mechanism. It's not a way of accomplishment. It's not a path of getting what we want in our lives. It is a path of acceptance and surrender. And it really only ever comes down to, what are you paying attention to?
Hmm. And then you go to the next question after you've asked, and then it's, do I have the strength?
Yeah, that really is the second question. And I needed to give some space to that in the book, because that is where we talked about the trickiness of following the third step of doing what you're told. We get the answer and it is often the exact opposite of what we want to do. And I still struggle with that sometimes. It's, you know, I come up against a situation, I'll ask, what's the loving thing to do? I'll get my answer and I want to chicken out. Mm-hmm. I want to not do it. And I began to practice the idea of, do I have the strength for that? And the answer over time will always end up being a yes, because that question takes us out of our personality. It's not really the eye of my ego that's got the strength. It's the eye of my soul. It's the eye of who I truly, truly am. And in that place, I'm infinite. In that place, I'm whole and unstoppable, really. And it reorients us, that second question of, do I have the strength for that? And it's part of the practice of connecting with the part of us that is infinite.
Right. The second principle is, love is everywhere and everything.
Mm-hmm. And it gets back to that notion of love being the essence of who we are. And it is, in my opinion, a universal energy. And it's big L love. I mean, that's where this distinction becomes very important. Right. Because little L love isn't everywhere. Big L love is. It's always present. It's always a possibility. There's no stopping it. And it's in absolutely all of us. It's between all of us. And it's there as a possibility all of the time. It's just a question of whether or not we're choosing it. And that's, again, getting back to the will. What are we paying attention to? Are we looking for the love in every moment? Or are we looking for what is wrong? Are we looking for the peace and the grace and the stillness and the joy? Or are we looking based on our past experiences of what's going to the next shoe and the next, you know, the next step of what might happen that will restrict us and make us scared and the next person that's going to hurt us? You know, what are we paying attention to? What are we looking for? And it really is there all of the time. And that's the joy of the practice. When you start to believe that, and it does, I break the chapter down into, you know, you have to believe the ridiculous and believe the impossible, because again, love asks us to throw status quo and social protocol and what we're used to right out the window. And we need to train ourselves to a whole new level of awareness and stop looking at the details and look for the love behind them.
Right. And details get us all wrapped up.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. It's so easy to get lost in details. And, you know, that doesn't require any teaching at all. I mean, there's not a single person in the world who can't identify with that, the statement of getting lost in the details. We mm-hmm. all do it. It's epidemic in this particular culture.
And it's the way that we try to control things.
Exactly. And it's the way we fill the emptiness that we're feeling spiritually. We fill ourselves up with stuff. We fill ourselves up with details. And then they just rattle around and make us feel more empty in the long run.
Mm-hmm. Talk about shame. I thought that was a very interesting
concept. Shame is, in my opinion, one of the most self-hurtful emotions that any of us can have. It is so damaging, and we get lost in it, and we get completely caught up in this notion that we're not good enough. And actually, one of the most this is a concept that's not in the book because I just started teaching it recently. And that is that we have this nagging, haunting feeling that we're not good enough. And the reason we have that's actually a natural expression, because when we're rooted in our human self, we have this instinct that we're limited. We have this instinct that there's something more. But because we're rooted in our human self and we're trapped in those details, that translates up into our conscious mind as I'm not enough. And we get caught in the shame as a result. And so the idea of feeling that we're not enough is actually a natural symptom of being stuck in our personalities. And if we can, and when we can, step into our core, that begins to evaporate and alleviate. But the shame itself is something that I think we all carry. It's a collective wound. It happened because somewhere in the evolution of humanity, we stepped out of who we really are. And it's something that I believe individually we all have to heal. And then collectively as a society, we create so many patterns based on I'm not enough, you're not enough, you need to be better for me. It's mm-hmm. it's the basis of almost every single problem we have in this culture. And to confront it and to heal it and to wrap love around it and allow that to transform, I believe, is one of the next major journeys for humanity.
Hmm. It's an interesting one, though, because it is part of the collective unconscious. And most people, you know, aren't necessarily aware of themselves, let alone, you know, aware of what we come down here with, that collective unconscious aspect of.
Absolutely. Well, that collective unconscious is the little ball and chain we carry around sometimes. I mean, it is something that, you're right, that most of us don't have an awareness of. And even when we begin to practice conscious awareness, it takes a long time to really come to full terms with what we've got stored in us and what we're carrying around with us, both from our own lives, what we brought into this life to deal with mm-hmm. and work
like
through.
Like it's not enough, right?
Exactly. So it truly is this place of each individual stepping forward and taking as complete responsibility as they can in the moment And then as we come together, I believe it's going to cascade out and it's going to become easier and easier. We're the pioneers in this. We're the ones taking all the arrows, right? So, but we're forging a path and we're making it easier for the next people to step into it themselves.
And I think one of the biggest things is that we keep identifying with this story, these tales that we create of, you know, not being enough or whatever it is that we're trying to learn. And then we reinforce that story by telling it to everybody and, you know, holding on to it like it's our only life force and, you know, and let everybody know. And it's, I mean, at some point, obviously, we got a lot of energy from it, but it, you know, it no longer serves us.
Yeah, absolutely. And the stories are detrimental, extremely detrimental to our growth because they stop us. Mm-hmm. And they are a function of the personality. And again, this is why so much of my work is about get out of the details, get out of the story and put yourself in your core. The stories come as a result of, again, being disconnected from the infinite source of big L love that we all carry within us, that we all live. But we get scared as children. We bump into certain circumstances that scare us, that hurt us, and no one's there to teach us how to be resilient to those situations because the people who are raising us weren't taught how to be resilient. Mm-hmm. So if we are able to be spiritually resilient in the face of those challenges, they could just be details. They could remain simply circumstances, things that hurt us, but they don't need to become who we are.
Right.
But because they're left unresolved, they become unresolved emotional experiences and they become stuck spots in our energy and they begin to collect energy around them and they begin to become a part of our identity. And that's where the stories are. And you're absolutely right. We tell them again and again and again until the pain of living in the story is outweighed by the pain of not living your truth. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's really, it's a question of story versus truth. And sooner or later for most individuals, that pain will become an imbalance. You know, the pain of not growing will outweigh the pain of staying stuck and staying where you are. And so you have to reach for the next level. Mm-hmm. And that's when we start to break through those stories.
Yes. And they keep us separate.
Mm-hmm.
So the third principle. It's around love, power, and courage.
The third principle, yes, love is found through courage and is what I mentioned earlier, the courageous conversations and having the courage to face the tough situations. Courage really is a necessary component to living big L love. I don't know if it's all that necessary for living little L love. I mean, when we're talking about just the pure emotion of love, I think it sort of breeds its own courage in some ways. But when we're talking about spiritual love and really integrating it into our lives, it requires courage because it requires us to confront those things that keep us stuck. And it requires us to confront our comfort zones and move beyond them. And it requires that we look within ourselves to the places that are dark and sometimes twisty and scary and go through them knowing that there is light on the other side. And I'm a really strong believer in the notion that courage is the dawning of love's presence, like that it is when we find love, that is courage.
Yeah. You talk about how fear and excitement are opposite ends of the same spectrum.
Isn't that an interesting concept? If you think about it, fear and excitement really physiologically feel almost exactly the same in our bodies. It's just what we label it. And if we're trapped in the limitation, it's going to feel like fear. But if it's something that we feel like we anticipate with joy, it's going to feel like excitement. But it's got that same sort of nervous tension energy. Mm. And that is a perfect example of that the will is all about what we're paying attention to. Because we can shift fear to excitement, or excitement can shift back to fear on a dime. I mean, we've all had those moments, right? Where we don't even know if something is inspiring us or making us daunted, right? We can flip back and forth between those two emotions because they are on the same continuum.
Hmm. Yeah. You know, you put in a quote of saying that it's one of your favorite authors. And I have to say, when I was younger, I love Charles DeLint. Mm. I mean, just loved him. And it's about the magic and how we've buried the magic.
Beneath too many quests for power, too much greed and too many quests for power. I really, truly believe that we have been so disconnected from our real power source that we end up questing for it in our personalities and through that control, and it absolutely buries the magic of life. I mean, life is magical. Mm. It is beauty expressing constantly, and that it's dripping with magic everywhere we go, and having that childlike sense of wonder and awe. I mean, one of my first teachings was, I used to walk around saying life couldn't get more wonderful. And then I said, wait a minute, that's awfully limiting. Okay, life could get more wonderful. It's maybe it's just that there'd be always new and interesting things to be wondering at. You know, there's just always something new to wonder at. And it's endless that way. But when we get into feeling like we're not enough and telling our stories and getting trapped in the details, we need our power externally. And that magic is one of the first things that gets lost.
Yeah, I agree. There's so much, even now, you know, as we come into the holiday season, mm-hmm. and I've always felt that magic. It had nothing to do with gifts. It had nothing to do with, you know, just, there's just a magic about this time. And it's so easy to get caught up in our everyday lives and forget that magic.
It really, truly is. And again, that brings us right back to, what are we paying attention to?
Right.
Are we paying attention to the details, or are we paying attention to the energy that's within them? What do we feel is important? And when we start looking at the energy, why we're doing what we're doing, what energy are we putting out into the world? Are we contributing, or are we contaminating the situation? Are we making it better? Are we striving for peace, or are we making it worse by projecting more fear? And that magic lies in every moment. And the key is to be willing to find it, to believe it's there, even when it doesn't look like it's there. And this is where the principles start to work together, because the second principle is that it's everywhere and you have to train yourself to look for it. But without the courage of the third principle, that's not so easy.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. Oh, you wrote something about fear being the absence of conscious love. I like that.
When that phrase didn't come to me until I was writing that chapter. And when I wrote it, I thought I was having one of my better moments, actually. Because it really, fear is the absence of conscious love. That really is all it is. And it is a vibration in our consciousness, in our bodies, in our hearts and minds, that is the natural symptom of not being connected to love. When we're living big L love, that fear can't vibrate like that. But when we're disconnected, there is a vibration. It's a vibration of absence. It's a vibration of, there's an emptiness that has a space. It has a voice. It has a texture and a color and a smell, and it's got a life of its own, that absence. And when it vibrates, we feel it as fear. Mm-hmm. It bubbles up into our consciousness as fear, and therefore breeds more of itself in our own consciousness. And then as we share it and we start flinging it around at each other, and it just gets bigger and bigger, and we end up where we are.
Yes. The fourth principle, love's power activated by choice.
Yes, and we have talked about this throughout. See, this is the one thing about, I break the principles down, but they weave into all of the work. You can't, love is there, and without the courage, we can't find it, because we're not going to go looking for it unless we cultivate the courage. But then once we find it, I say in the book, what's the use of finding it if we don't choose it, if we don't actively engage it, if we're not participating in it? And that's what that principle is all about, is the active participation in love and integrating it into our lives. Because, you know, you and I could think of ourselves as the most loving being in the world, but it's easy to do that behind a closed door, sitting in our meditation table, you know, with our crystals if we do it that way, or, you know, chanting if we do it that way. We feel, and we've all had that experience, right?
Okay, this brings up my favorite quote. Oh, just, it's beautiful. Not even till later, but it it's one of the only parts that made me really laugh, mm-hmm. and it's called the Daily Prayer. Dear God, I am so grateful for my life. Today, I have envisioned my life with love, compassion, and purpose. So far, I have embraced every moment with faith and extended sweet kindness to all beings in the world. I have practiced appreciation and I have celebrated all aspects of who I am. I am at peace, in love, and with spirit. But God, I am about to get out of bed now, and I think I'm going to need your help. Amen. That's beautiful.
We've all had that experience of just blissing ourselves into this Zen space in our own privacy, and then walking across the room, putting our hand on the door handle and feeling terribly normal, you know, like just, it can crash down around, the life can just burst through, and it's all about the choices. And I put that prayer in there for a reason, because that is how we feel so much of the time. It's easy when we're in our Zen space, when we're in our blissed out wonderful zone,
yeah,
but it's in the day-to-day, moment-to-moment interactions and choices that it really counts. And one of my favorite quotes from Dr. Ernest Holmes, who pioneered the religious science, or what's now called the Centers for Spiritual Living teachings, he actually talked about the fact that his teachings weren't worth a dime if they weren't demonstrated. If they weren't put into action, they weren't worth the paper they were written on. And I loved that. I loved hearing that. And I feel the same way about practicing love. If you're doing it for yourself in your own life, and then you walk out into the world and you nag your partner and you yell at your coworkers and you flip the bird to someone on the road, you know, you're not living love. You've got to choose it in every moment. And those are some extreme examples. It can get down to really, really subtle things. Like, are you willing to smile at the person behind the cash register, even when you don't feel like it? You know, just for the sake of giving a little something of yourself beyond what you think you can in the moment. That's an act of love. Mm-hmm. Are you willing to walk up to someone on the street and say, that's a fabulous dress? That's an act of love. It makes people smile. It brightens their day. It's a regular practice of mine to walk up to total strangers and give them compliments, because it's such joy to share it on that level. And it is an act of love, and it's a small one.
Yeah. It's an interesting aspect of life. If we can, you know, always look for something, because there's always something. And I mean, you may be in a conflict with somebody that is just ripping you apart. Mm-hmm. But if you really think about it, or you really look for love, you can find something.
Absolutely.
That will transcend that pain into, you know, opening yourself up again, even if it's just a tiny little bit.
Yes. And that's it, because the smallest of spaces, I mean, that's something I talk about in the book. Willingness is the key to everything. And we only need the tiniest little crack in our own surface, and love can come all the way in, because wherever love is, all of love is. And if we can create just the smallest little bit of willingness in ourselves, the entire creative power of the universe is living in that tiny little space. That's another lesson I received from my particular struggles with illness. I mean, I'm the kind of person that can create entire universes before breakfast. I mean, that's just, I dream big. A husband of a friend of mine, after she got off the phone with me once, and he was listening to her end of the conversation, and she filled him in on what I had said, and on the other end, and he just got this look on his face. Apparently, she told me this later, and he said, Why does Aria always have to dream so big? And I'm like, well, what's the point? If you're not going to dream big, why dream? You know, that's just who I am. And at the same time, I was living in a body for a very long time where I couldn't do much, right? And I felt like I had universes of love to give, but on a daily basis, I was measuring it out in teaspoons. Mm-hmm. That's how I felt. I've got oceans, mountains, universes of love, and I've got a teaspoon to give for the day. And it wasn't until I started to really understand that the entire creative power of the universe lives in that teaspoon. And it's only my judgment of limitation that's making it feel small. That was one of the major turning points in my own physical healing. When I learned how to, that was another point of acceptance and surrender. Mm-hmm. See how it all ties in?
It does. It all ties in. Your fifth principle is about gratitude.
This is one of my favorites. I really believe that love can't thrive without gratitude. It is gratitude is a spiritual practice and a spiritual principle all of its own.
Yeah.
And we can stimulate incredible spiritual growth for ourselves simply through practicing gratitude. And I break gratitude down in the book into three faces. Mm-hmm. Celebration, which is sort of obvious and self-evident, and acceptance and anticipation. Anticipation is being that, you know, grateful for things before they show up and practicing that. But acceptance, a lot of people don't realize that it's a form of gratitude, but it really is. The absence of fighting, the absence of resistance is a form of gratitude.
Right.
Just being with it and saying, I am grateful, not necessarily for the details themselves, but for being alive to experience them and for just being in it. And I really do encourage people through the gratitude teachings to try to stop saying I'm grateful for, but to say I'm grateful within. I'm grateful in this. Because gratitude, I believe, isn't just an attitude. It's got to be more than that. It's got to be a life choice. And it is in of itself a spiritual vibration. And so, like love, it's everywhere all of the time if we can just learn how to choose it. And when we practice gratitude for things, we're technically hooking it's conditional again. Mm. Even the best, most amazing, expansive things that we can be grateful for, does that mean our gratitude evaporates if they're not in our lives? If that circumstance changes, what happens to my gratitude? Gratitude needs to transcend circumstance in the same way love does. So, and I still will say I'm grateful for. I mean, I'm not perfect in that practice myself because I'm still learning it. Like, that's something that's it's a deep level of practice that I'm still working on.
Yeah. Well, I always remember reading Debbie Ford and how she, mm-hmm. you know, suggests that you find the gift. And it's truly not until you can find that gift that you can be truly grateful. Because mm-hmm. as you say, gratitude is much more than, you know, saying, oh, I am grateful. Unless you actually feel and have that opening and awareness of love, it's not really truly gratitude.
Right. But again, I mean, there's a whole section in that chapter called Even When It's Hard.
Yeah.
And I am a big advocate of not looking for the gift if it's not readily apparent. Because that's we get into fighting again. And we get into those unrealistic expectations. There are going to be circumstances that hurt so deeply, that causes grief, that causes shock, that take a while for our personality to catch up to the healing of what our spirit is able to do. There are times when we're just, those two things aren't quite at the same pace, and that's perfectly natural. So that gratitude in those moments are about being able to wrap those feelings up in love and be in the love and be in the gratitude. Again, not for a specific gift. If there's a gift apparent, celebrate it, raise it up in gratitude and focus on that because it makes it easier. It makes it easier to find that willingness to put a crack in the door and let love come in. However, sometimes there's nothing to celebrate. And if our human side doesn't feel strong enough to go looking for the gratitude, go looking for the gift, I mean, our spirit can still feel gratitude.
Right.
And that's the more subtle side of the practice.
Yeah. And challenging.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
I mean, eventually once you've moved through that grief and you've allowed and you've accepted that grief, you will still find a gift.
Absolutely.
But yes, it does take a while.
And there are times when, you know, our human side of things aren't really ever going to understand.
Right.
And that's, again, giving up that notion of control.
So the sixth principle is similar in some ways to the second principle, but it's every breath, every word, every moment, love.
Absolutely. You're right. They are very similar. The second principle talks about just training ourselves to be aware that love is available to us in every moment. And the sixth is about integrating it into the choice and realizing that, again, it's not worth anything if we're not living it as fully as we can in every single moment and really training our human life and our lifestyle into being a lifestyle of love.
You talk about in this chapter the 100th monkey syndrome and reading reaching critical mass, which is very important. And I think certainly something that is occurring within humanity at this point.
I am so excited about this on a daily basis, because I've seen it happening over and over again. And it's something that, for example, if you ever go to a workshop or a conference where everyone's conscious and practicing, you know, their own form of loving spirituality, you can't help but feel like the air hangs thick with it, you know, by the end of it, and that the possibilities and the potentials, the power of coming together, the power of knowing we're not alone, the power of really getting in our bones that we are walking this path together, makes us more powerful. And it's never a question of straight addition. It's not 1 + 1 = right. 2. It's 1 + 1, right? So right. The more people we bring together, the greater the power is. And it's something I talk about in the book, because I wanted to make sure that even those people who have no concept of what it's like to stand in a room with 100 other people or 500 other people who are all dedicated to a common vision of oneness for the planet can start to get a sense of the fact that their own individual contribution is priceless. Mm-hmm. The universe can't go on without anyone. Like, if any one of us were to blip out of existence, I don't know what our universe would be. We're all so intricate and we're all so necessary. And our own individual contribution can create absolute miracles.
Yeah. You do talk in this chapter about how gossip and that outer dialogue with judgment and stress and the media and how it interferes and impacts our lives.
It really is a set of toxic symptoms. I mean, if the goal is in love to integrate it into our lives, then we have to focus on what keeps us strong in that and stay away from what weakens us. Stay away from what makes it easier to lapse into the fear. And we talked about doing what we're told to do. When we follow the guidance that love gives us, love never tells us to gossip. Mm-hmm. Love never tells us to make up a story about why someone else is feeling that way and decide that it's the truth and never be willing to question our assumption. And not only that, but continue to act as if that is the truth with that person. I mean, love doesn't guide us in that direction. So judgment and assumptions and criticism and gossip and so much of how the media presents itself and what we do with our leisure time and our entertainment and all of those things, it they all weaken us. And we need to begin to make stronger choices. Choices that resonate more clearly with love.
Mm-hmm. So the seventh principle is love for love's sake.
Yes, and this is one of the ones that is sort of the most esoteric and yet, in my opinion, also one of the ones that drives us to the most practical form of application, because it's really learning to let go of outcome, learning to release our attachment to the details. And I think, again, coming full circle to where we started this conversation, getting out of the notion that we're the ones in control,
mm-hmm.
That they're really surrendering and accepting the idea that there is a greater power moving through us, and to form everything in our lives as service to that power. We love for love's sake and only for love's sake, not to get anything out of it, not to bargain our way to a better life through working with love. And that's one of the hardest, again, in this accomplishment-driven culture. We really do have a strong tendency in our new thought spirituality to think that if I can bargain with God for the life that I want, if I do everything right and I follow all the principles, and well, then I'm going to get whatever I want. And I disagree wholeheartedly that the universe is one big giant catalog that you can just order up from. I mean, I know there are teachers out there that put that forward. I don't think there's anything wrong with it. And I'm not going to argue with them. I'm just going to say I don't agree with you and teach something else. And to me, it's for the love, with the love, on behalf of love, to love. I mean, otherwise, what's the point?
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, we're not living our true essence. And that really is what it's all about. Love is the true essence of who we are. So if we're not living for love's sake, we're not living the truth of who we are.
Yeah. And you know, a lot of what you talked about, some of those teachers out there, and it was necessary to get people to become a little bit more aware mm-hmm. of, you know, possibilities.
Mm-hmm.
But certainly, I like to teach as well that it's really the qualities.
Yes.
Not the quantity. It's not
exactly.
It's not what you're picking out. It's what will that, what you're wanting, give you.
Yes.
And then act like you have it instead of.
Yes. And that actually is the essence of the teaching of it's not the details. It's the energy behind the details.
Right. Okay.
Right. It's not the stuff. It's not the circumstance. It's how we feel in it. It's what it means to us. It's the significance that we bring to it and what we're looking for from it.
Yeah. It's all very magical.
It is. I love that word.
Well, we are doing quite well. Do you want to briefly talk about the three pillars?
My three pillars. I love these three pillars.
All right.
Responsiveness, presence, and release. These are the three sort of personality pillars that this system stands on. The idea is that with these three pillars, it sort of they enliven, they support, they feed the practice of the work. And I put them in that last chapter because I really felt that there was something missing in that capacity from what I had written so far. I wanted to give people a chance to sort of look from a perspective point of view, because a lot of it is deep spiritual principle and getting into the nitty gritty of practice. But, you know, what do I do with my personality while that's happening, you know? And responsiveness is the first one. It's one of my favorite things in the world to talk about it. The best way to sum it up is to say, show up to life with a yes. You know, the universe is an affirmative force. And it doesn't just say yes to everything we say or think and feel and put out into it. It says, and so it is. All the activations end with, and so it is. And it's an affirmative creative force. The universe creates through affirmation. So when we show up in responsiveness, when we show up with a yes to life, we are mimicking the very nature of the universe. And we're training our personality to look like and act like the way the universe creates. And I just get so excited when I think about that concept, because that's where we can really tap into that infinite power for ourselves. And we can take a look at imagining what life could be like from that place. Presence is then, what do we fill that space with? And it just is a reminder for all of us that we get to decide who we are. And one of my favorite things to do is to teach people that there is essentially one quality that represents your presence. And a lot of people know it already, but it actually, my colleague, Michael Mirdad, phrased it beautifully one day. He said, you know, if there's probably one word that best represents your relationship with God or the universe or love, if there's one word that just makes your heart sing and sets your spirit free, for me, that is love. But it's not always that for people. Sometimes it's peace or wholeness or grace or serenity, joy, inspiration, freedom. And there's that one word. And if you can focus in on that one word and be that word and allow that to form the essence of your presence, then you're supporting the work of integrating love into your life probably better than you could do with any other technique. And then the third pillar is release. And this is all about staying in the flow, releasing attachment to the outcome, releasing attachment to the details, staying open, staying free to be able to be shaped by the guidance we receive from love instead of being shaped in response to the details, right? We want to be responsive to love, not responsive to circumstance. And the way to do that is to stay in release and to stay in the flow. And that, again, mimics one of the fundamental mechanisms of creation, because creation never stops moving. It never stagnates. There's an essential stillness at the core of the universe, but that's not stagnation. And the universe is constantly flowing and changing and growing and evolving and demonstrating. And so by keeping ourselves in a state of release, again, we're mimicking the creative nature of the universe and making ourselves who we're truly destined to be. I mean, the pillars are sort of where our life and our destiny come together. Our human personality is able to get a hold of the coattails of our greatest power and our greatest truth, and start to pull on that pull on that cloak and be that cloak and allow the true nature of love to flow forward. So I guess you could tell the joy in my voice as I talk about my three pillars. I love them.
Wow. Okay. So, you know, that's the basis of your book, but there is so lot more mm-hmm. information that they can get when they actually read it. So tell people how they can get a hold of your book and how they can get a hold of you.
Lovethreshold.com is my home site, and the book is available in the store. There's also all sorts of supplemental materials as well to support. I've got activations that they can buy individually or in compilations. There's an activation membership plan if they really like the activations and want to use it as a tool to support them. There's a plan you can buy into to have activations sent to you through MP3 format on a weekly basis, along with lessons that you can do if you want to integrate the energy. And lovethreshold.blog.com is another key resource. I'm building it right now as a open source community center for all of us who are interested in practicing love in our lives. And there's a weekly podcast available on that. And we're going to be getting into doing interviews with other leaders and having articles posted from other leaders. And it's going to be, over the next year, going to grow into something pretty spectacular. So nice. Those would be the two ways, lovethreshold.com or lovethreshold.blog.com.
Awesome. Well, it has been a delight, and I think we've gotten a full hour of content for our listeners to expand their own consciousness and understand love.
Well, thank you, Lori, so much. I often say that this is my heaven, so that makes you my angel, and it makes the listeners out there my angels. So thank you so much for giving me this opportunity.
It's been my pleasure.